Coming up on Philosophy Talk, a show about nothing.
I'm really serious. I think that's a good idea.
Just talking? Well, what's the show about?
It's about nothing.
Existentialism. Meaninglessness.
Nothingness.
The existentialist philosophers did insist that we had particular moral obligations to others, namely to promote the other people's freedom.
Our guest is Lanier Anderson of Stanford University.
They didn't want to insist on more substantive moral demands than that. The crux of it is there is no essence of what it is to be a human being until human beings invent ways of life for themselves.
Nothing from nothing leaves nothing. You gotta have something if you wanna be with me. Yeah. Yes.
They say, what's your show about? I say nothing.
There you go.
I think you may have something here.
Existentialism.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk after the news.
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, local innovative public radio for San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the lovely Stanford campus.
Yes, and from that oasis of thought, we migrate to the air via this oasis of radio, and from the air to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Go check it out. And now you can listen to Philosophy Talk anywhere, anytime, by downloading our podcast from our website.
So, Ken, today we're talking about existentialism. Now, existentialism, the word, was invented by Jean-Paul Sartre. And I guess you get to be an existentialist as if Jean-Paul Sartre said you were an existentialist, because there's a lot of them that were dead before they knew they were existentialists.
Like Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, they never called themselves existentialists, but everybody thinks of them as existentialists.
Yeah, even Dostoevsky gets to be an existentialist. He's included in all the anthologies.
Yeah, and existentialists seem to be a strange bunch, because Nietzsche was an atheist, Kierkegaard was a Christian, Sartre is an atheist. I mean, you know, it's a doctrine with many facets.
I guess what they all believe, or at least Sartre thought they believed, was that existence precedes essence.
Now, what does that mean, John?
Well, at its core, I think existentialism is something, I mean, the starting point is something every philosophy professor agrees and feels passionately about. You're talking to kids in intro philosophy, and you want them to know that they are not just a collection of stuff poured in their heads by parents, culture, ministers, schools, and the newspapers they happen to read. Ultimately, what they are is up to them. Everybody in the world can say that they're going to be a lawyer, and they can still say, no, I'm going to be a doctor or a businessman or major in English lit. Ultimately, you're condemned to be free, and that's a starting point.
Condemned to be free. Why condemned? I mean, it sounds like freedom is a burden, right? And freedom is a burden. You can never escape the responsibility for making yourself who you choose to be. Is if, because I guess Sartre says that if you think, well, look, I need to be a lawyer because my parents would be crushed if I didn't become a lawyer. And if you think they're being crushed is a reason for you, and that you don't just have the absolutely free choice to be a lawyer or not, then you're acting in bad faith, Sartre says, right?
Yes, and so I think existentialism really appeals to every 17-year-old. It certainly appealed to me when I was that age. And there's something true that remains true. But, you know, Sartre got out of this a huge theoretical philosophy with all kinds of technical terms like in itself and for itself and the subjectivity of the in itself being for itself. Or
God, you're really up on your existentialism.
It runs about to 800 pages in translation, so there, maybe you can understand the fact that it's not the world's most popular philosophy now.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think it's a very popular philosophy. It's one of those books that everybody says they will someday read. But to see how popular it is, to see whether it has any contemporary relevance, our roving philosophical reporter, Polly Stryker, went out and talked to two psychotherapists about existentialism. She files this report.
It may be surprising to find out that existential philosophy is used in psychotherapy. I spoke with two mental health professionals, a father and son. Both of them look at existential issues in their practices.
Existential psychotherapy is an approach to psychotherapy that helps people to live their lives in a more full way, in a more authentic way, and in a more meaningful way.
San Francisco psychologist Victor Yalom believes that existential ideas are really woven into the human condition. His father, Dr. Irvin Yalom, is a Stanford psychiatrist.
It may be that the patient explicitly comes in with some kind of existential issue. Maybe one of the most familiar ones is a fear of death. Other patients may come in because of a crisis of meaning in their life. We happen to be creatures who seem to thrive on some kind of meaning or want some type of meaning. And so one of our major tasks in life is to go about constructing a meaning that is sturdy enough to maintain this life. It may be that they're at kind of midlife and suddenly they don't quite know what they're working for and what means a great deal to them, and the children have left the home and there's an empty nest. So these are things they want to talk about.
How does the use of existential ideas in psychotherapy differ from, say, Freudian psychotherapy?
There's a whole major difference in the frame of reference, where Freud was much more interested in the development of sexuality. He would not be dealing with a patient who may be thinking of frightened of death. He would translate death into something else, maybe castration, rather than dealing with death as a specific entity that we have to face.
Dr. Yalom says existential ideas changed the way he approaches his work.
I got my baptism when I worked for several years with patients who were facing death. All my training in psychotherapy left us very little with how we could approach it. I had to learn a whole new skill and learn that I had to face these issues in myself and that I had to be present for the patient. And I had to deal with them in a different way because they weren't separate from me. It wasn't them, the patients, who had this affliction, and we, the healers, who didn't, you know, because we're all in the same boat. We're all facing mortality, and I think that drastically alters the kind of attitude one has towards the relationship between patients and therapists, where I feel much more that we're all fellow travelers, or Nietzsche or Schopenhauer would put it, that we're all fellow sufferers.
An important existential concept is to live a fully engaged life. In other words, not just coasting down life's highway. Psychologist Victor Yalom.
A lot of us have gotten really cut off from, you know, what's our essence? What excites us in life? If you only had another day or you only had another year to live, what would you be doing? Would you be going to your job downtown in your office and your cubicle and looking at your computer screen all day? I think that we all have a certain kind of essence that if we go back and think about how we were as a very young child and the teens and early adulthood, if you think about what are the times you were most alive, and you can find a way to tap into that more and more, then you can live a more authentic life. I think the people that we see that are artists or just passionate about what they do, whether they're artists or musicians or intellectuals, you know, these are the people you see in their 70s or their 80s or their 90s, and they're full of life, you know?
From the intersection of philosophy and psychotherapy, I'm Polly Stryker for Philosophy Talk.
Thanks, Polly, and thanks to Irvin and Victor Yalom for those interesting ruminations on castration, death, despair, psychotherapy, and existentialism. Yeah. I'm John Perry, and with me is that font of authenticity, Ken Taylor.
Yeah, right. I love how she roved to the intersection of philosophy and psychotherapy today. Our guest today is Lanier Anderson. He's an associate professor of philosophy at Stanford University. He's an award-winning teacher, an amazing guy. He's the author of many articles on German philosophy, Kant, Nietzsche, all kinds of stuff. A recent article is Nietzsche on Truth, Illusion, and Redemption. That's particularly pertinent to our topic today. Lanier, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
I'm delighted to be here.
Well, Lanier, we're delighted to have you. Now, in our little intro, Ken and I fumbled around with the idea that existence precedes essence, the slogan of Sartre's existentialism. Why don't you take a minute and give us a little bit deeper understanding of that fundamental idea?
I'm not sure it'll be deeper, but here's a stab anyway. Look, something has an essence if it has a nature that fixes the way it's going to behave and how it has to be. And the idea that existence precedes essence is supposed to contrast the human situation with the situation of other things in the world and artifacts. So a paring knife, for example, comes into existence because somebody has an idea of the nature of the thing that they're looking for, right? They want a knife that's good for cutting and peeling fruit. And so that fixes what kind of norms will dictate what makes a good object of this sort.
So the essence precedes existence for a paring knife.
The essence that establishes what will be a good one comes first. Then you make one that matches that essence. With a human being, it's supposed to be the opposite. There is no essence of what it is to be a human being until human beings invent ways of life for themselves. That was Sartre's idea.
Well, I want to have children. I'm a farmer in some rural society, agrarian society, and I want to have children to plow my fields. And I want them to have filial piety and all that stuff. And I give birth to my children, and I raise them so that they will be adept farmers and that they'll have filial piety and obey my commandments. I have an idea of my children. I give birth to them. I make them to be what I choose them to be.
Yeah, Sartre's idea is that they might, in fact, turn out the way you want, but it's actually up to them whether they do or not. So, the essence that you try to put on them is something that they either will take up for themselves and make their own or not.
So here's Ken, the rural farmer, and his kid, Clem, gets to be age 18, and he really wants to go be a rock musician and smoke dope. But his dad says, no, you stay here and be on the farm. And ultimately, it's up to him. If he says, dad says, I got to be on the farm, so I got to stay on the farm, I guess that's what Sartre would call bad faith.
Depends on how his project really plays out for him. But if he continues to wish all the time to be a rock musician smoking dope in the big city and sitting around complaining that he's oppressed by his father, da, 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 then yes, he's in bad faith, because Sartre insists it's up to him to take responsibility for his situation and seize the day.
Okay, but now suppose Clem decides he wants to be an elephant or a bird or a typewriter. I mean, it looks like he's got his essential human nature to deal with. Some essence precedes his decisions, doesn't it?
So there are some basic features of our condition, and Sartre called these things facticity. So I'm short, you're tall. I'm slow, you're fast. That's a very famous thing about you.
John is not too fast. Otherwise, he'd be a third baseman.
Yeah. So there are these basic features that are given to us in existence, and Sartre calls those things facticity. But the idea behind his view is that this sort of facticity can have an actual meaningful impact on somebody's life only because it interacts in a meaningful way with their projects. And the meanings that those elements of facticity have depend on the projects that the people carry out.
Let's think about how much can be given to a person and how much room there is really for freedom, how much externalities can constrain me. It's not just the physical externalities. Okay, I'm not very fast, right? I weigh a certain amount. I'm also born into a certain situation, surrounded by certain others. My father, you know, I might like to go off and be a rock musician with my father's blessing, but whether I get the blessing or not is not up to me. It's up to him, right? I might want to be able to take other people's money without any consequences, but whether there are consequences are not up to me. It's up to those people that surround me. So there's things given by my physical nature, by my biological nature, by the social surroundings in which I find myself, by the desires and wishes of others. How much room is there really left? I mean, it sounds like Sartre believes in this kind of radical freedom, but isn't a whole bunch of stuff given to me about which I can do nothing?
A whole bunch of stuff is given, and I guess where he would disagree with you is that very last thing you said, that you can do nothing about it. So he insists that even though in some sense it is given to you, there is something you can do about it. That facticity as a whole will interact with your projects in one way or another, and what kind of interaction it is will depend on which project you chose. And you will have chosen that project which gives the meaning to those things. Now, one thing that's counterintuitive about Sartre's view is that it seems easy for him to make this move with physical limitations. So those mountains over there that separate us from the beach, they're an impediment if I'm trying to get to the beach. They're good scenery if I'm trying to have a picnic. it's much harder to make this work with other people and their projects, since their freedom sets what meaning those things have.
We'll have to take that issue up some more. I think this is a deep and important thing we're getting at. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is existentialism. Our guest is Lanier Anderson from Stanford University.
We've been talking about the main themes of existentialism. Next, we're going to delve deeper into this notion of self-constitution. Think a bit about how your own self got constituted. Did your essence precede your existence, or the other way around? Let us know the answer. You can join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Nothingness, the self, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Edith Piaf and La Fou. This is Philosophy Talk, and I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing existentialism with Lanier Anderson. Won't you join us? Tell us about your moments of existential angst, or your moments of enlightenment, or self-overcoming. Have you constituted yourself from whole cloth, from nothingness? Tell us.
The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org. If you go to our website, you can email us from there. Make sure to look for the comments button, not any of the other attractive buttons you'll see there.
Yeah. Our guest today is Lanier Anderson from Stanford University. So, Lanier, start has lots of terms. The in itself, the for itself.
The in itself, the for itself. And you use the term project in this kind of technical way. Why don't you tell us a little bit about these technical ideas?
So a project is an organizing choice that a person makes that sets up the relations between means and ends in the person's life overall. And part of the reason he uses the word project to capture this idea is that a project is something that throws itself out toward the future. And it's in light of our future aims that our particular means and ends in the current context come to have the meaning that they do. So that's the idea of a project. And this project stretches out beyond what's actually immediately given to us, our own facticity, and also what's given to us as the in itself of the world. So that's another concept.
Itself of the world. What do you mean by the in itself of the world?
Well, the in itself for Sartre is a certain kind of being that things have, and the best way to get at it is by examples, I think. Ordinary objects that have no consciousness just have the being of in itself. So
the
table is a table, an inkwell is an inkwell. It's just there. It is what it is. And there's nothing that it does that can change that.
So that's the facticity of the in itself. One of my favorite pieces of vocabulary from all of philosophy, the facticity of the in itself.
How many radio programs have you heard the phrase, the facticity of the in itself on? I bet you not many.
Yeah, and then there's the facticity of the federal government, of NPR.
But another important notion, the for itself.
So the for itself is a different kind of being, the sort of being that human beings have, such that the being that is a for itself can take up an attitude toward the world and change thereby its relation to the world. So there is also a facticity of the for itself, and that's this famous fact that John was mentioning before, that the for itself is condemned to be free. It can't help but take up some attitude or other. If it tries to have no attitude, that's just one attitude it has thereby chosen.
So 415-841-4134, give us a call. Tell us what you think. You have an existential angst? Are you a being for itself, in itself? Existentialism says, you know, we have this condemned to be free. Do you feel that? But let me ask you a question, Lanier. Okay. So first, let me see if I got this for itself stuff just correctly. I'm no scholar of this stuff, so let's see if I put it in my own terms. So I'm a being, a for itself is a being that matters to itself. That I'm conscious of myself, and what I cognize myself as, that's mattering to myself. This cup is something maybe to me, but it's not anything to itself, right? It has no self-awareness. It makes no plans for itself. It's just there. And I can use it, abuse it, do whatever I want to it, and it won't resist. It won't say, don't hurt me, don't treat me that way, because it doesn't matter to itself. I mean, is that roughly the right way to think about it?
That seems right to me, yeah.
And a for itself is a consciousness. Now let me give myself a one-minute quiz here. I would say this recent movie, Transamerica, that right. the leading person is that is really an existentialist hero, because he or she, depending on when you're talking about the person, just doesn't take anything about themselves for granted. They are born a male. They don't want to be a male. Their parents are tremendously upset. Even their little sister isn't very supportive, but they go ahead with it. They not only change, you know, they adopt a project that seems to deal with some of the most things you couldn't change. So, would Sartre really agree with that?
I think so. I think so, and I think that's an excellent example. And what happens? That character does a very dramatic self-transformation in changing her or his basic way of being in the world for other people. But one of the excellent points about the movie is that is to show that there's a kind of continuity between what the main character does and what other people do. So when they get to the restaurant, there's a scene about the hormones, right? And the daughter points out to the mother, well, you know, I'm just taking hormones the same way you are.
But now the heroine there finds she has a son, right? Someone that she fathered. And she wants to just ignore that, right? That's part of her. That's part of his life, not part of my life. But her psychotherapist won't let her do that. Where would Sartre stand on the issue of your responsibility to your past when you make one of these self-constituting moves like she did?
This is an excellent question, I think. So Sartre has some ambivalence about our relation to our past. And in some modes, when it talks about, when we're talking about the way we relate to choices that we've made in the past, it seems that we do still maintain responsibility for that choice until we ourselves change it. And we are supposed to be taking up, and as he keeps putting it, reassuming that choice by continuing to endorse it. He does envision the possibility, however, that you could radically change your fundamental choice or your fundamental project. And if you did that, you're supposed to relate to your past choices in your past life as though it's another person. And in that case, you aren't supposed to have to take any responsibility for it at all.
Well, there's lots going on here, Lynn. I just want to slow it down a little bit. It's really complicated because take Transamerica. John's right in his interpretation of that. But look, I can't will myself to become a rich old white guy just by saying, that's what I shall be. And so it's not like everything that one could, that a person, that any, some person or other could be is open to me to be. Is it? I mean,
Hey, Ken, you couldn't will yourself to be a rich old black guy either.
Well, I could try to become a rich old black guy, but I can't even try to become a rich old white guy, can I? I mean, or
no.
Suppose I did. I might try to occupy John's social position or something like that. But there's something deeply inauthentic and problematic and self-loathing about any attempt to do that. Right?
That's. I think that's certainly right.
And how would we understand that limit in Sartrean terms?
So these are all elements of your facticity. And the attitude that he takes up toward these elements of facticity are that they set the confines or the constraints against which we choose. But the way he wants to think about these contours of that define our choice is that they're not just restricting conditions. Those are the enabling conditions out of which it makes sense for us to have some project or other. So if you have the project to become rich, then your current poverty is something that you choose as the thing that you're going to get rid of in becoming rich.
Right, right.
You're going to have to change jobs.
We have lots of phone lines open. We know you're out there. Have you ever had an identity crisis? How did you overcome it? How did you reconstitute yourself? How do you find meaning in your own life? Do you have Sartrean projects that determine your existence? Give us a call, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're eager to have you join us.
It's nice. We've got a message from an old friend, Pete in San Francisco. Hi, guys. Long time no talk. How did the existentialists, was it Sartre, use the myth of Sisyphus to illustrate their philosophy?
So it wasn't Sartre. It was actually Camus who wrote a whole book about the myth of Sisyphus. And the myth, of course, is this story about Sisyphus pushing a rock all the way up a hill, at which point, as soon as it gets close to the top, that rolls back down to the hill and his task starts all over again. So the significance that this took on for Camus and for other existentialists was really the idea that the important thing about life is the activity itself and not some external purpose to which the activity is subordinated. So the famous ringing closing line of that essay on the myth of Sisyphus is that, according to Camus, one must imagine Sisyphus happy. So in spite of how pointless and punitive this activity might seem to us, if you just changed your attitude toward it so that the activity itself took on a defiant character, then it could turn out to be an important and meaningful way of existing.
Well, now, Camus sounds like an existentialist to me, and Sartre thought he was. Why did Camus himself deny that he was an existentialist?
Because he had a falling out with Jean-Paul Sartre.
Oh, I see.
And after their falling out, Camus expressed himself by denying that he was an existentialist, and Sartre confirmed it. And of course, they did disagree on important, some important questions, but it is true also that there were a lot of important commonalities between their views.
I'm going to ask you a question about existential and this kind of unbridled freedom to take things as we like choose to take them or something like that. You know, some people are present to me as like deserving a certain kind of treatment, right? I don't have the right to murder you, right? Your being commands respect. At least many philosophers think that. The Sartrean seems to say, nah, I can choose to respect you or not. And if I think, well, I have to respect you because of your nature rather than something about me, that's bad faith. I mean, that seems like an odd thing to think.
Yeah, the crux of it is this is a place where many, many philosophers would depart fundamentally from existentialism and not only Sartre's version, but also the versions of these other people like Nietzsche who were dead before there was any such word, as you pointed out. I think this is a difficult question for the existentialists. The motivation for their view seems to me to be that the values that are supposed to underwrite these important relations that we have to the other people, those values can be binding for us, according to Sartre, only insofar as we take them up and endorse them. That's the real source of the values. And so really what he wants to insist upon is that it's not as though there's some value out there in the world that forces you to respect me. It's a matter of your recognition of that value that underwrites the moral relationship that we have.
Penny in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Penny.
Oh, hi. I'm not sure this is exactly on your subject, but you said something very intriguing to me about finding value in your life after an identity crisis or some such. And I've had cancer and talked to a lot of cancer patients, and one of the things that comes up for cancer patients is, how do I find value in my life now? What is its value now? How do I find the courage and the strength to go through treatment? And I was wondering what existentialists would say about that, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Penny. Excellent question. Lanier.
That is an excellent question. So one thing that's especially characteristic of existentialist thought is the idea that human beings can find a special source of value in life precisely by facing up to death in the right way. And so I think that the typical existentialist answer to your kind of dilemma would be to think about the way in which you might transform your relation to your life by the fact that you face up to death in that way. So the question, what value you find in your life, they won't actually provide you an answer to that. The idea is that that's something you have to invent for yourself. But they do think that facing up to your death forces the issue for you so that you come to see how important it is to address that question of value in your life and become forthright about it.
Ron in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Ron.
Well, I'll tell you this. I'm going to join your KALW next time they have a drive for money. You guys are wonderful.
Well, thanks, Rob.
I think you're getting a dearth of phone calls. It's called, I'm just writing down everything you're saying as I'm driving along here. But the question
wait, that's how dangerous, guy.
yeah, I know. It's not very safe either. The thing I want to present, my brother is the one that got me interested in existentialism many years ago, of which I never read or studied anything about. He wrote a master's thesis on the existentialism of Richard Wright. And I thought it was fascinating, and I could never understand my brother's explanation of what existentialism was or is. And maybe if you all have ever read Richard Wright, maybe you can give me a sense of what my brother was trying to tell me.
Okay, right. I think you've not only read Richard Wright, but probably taught Richard Wright. Isn't that right?
No, I haven't, actually. John and I had a student who worked on some Richard Wright, and he also had this idea that... there was something deeply existentialist about it, but I haven't worked on the text myself.
There's what's the hero in the anti-hero? Booger, is that his name? The guy who commits the murder.
Bigger.
Yeah, Bigger. There's a line in Native Son in which he owns up to the act of murder, and he says, "I killed because of what I am," right? And that's a moment of clarity for him. And kind of self-constitution, that he did this. It wasn't something forced upon him. It's something he did, right? And that somehow makes it authentically his act. So, I mean, there is that kind of thing, right? Do things that you can authentically own as your own, right? Richard Wright, by the way, is the author of the great, great novel, Native Son.
Over many years, I've had a number of African-American students, undergraduate and graduate, who found the work of existentialists, particularly Nietzsche, but also Sartre, really compelling, and that used to puzzle me. I'd say, well, you know, these are white guys, dead white guys, Europeans. Why does this have so much meaning? And it is this idea that I think, at least in America, African Americans often have a very constricted set of roles made available to them. And this is what our student Charles Watson developed in his dissertation, right? So they need a philosophy that says, you know, it's up to you to invent what you're going to be. Don't expect your life plan to be handed to you by a society. You've got this ultimate freedom and responsibility for deciding what you want to do to transcend yourself.
And no matter the facticity that surrounds you, right? I mean, you even in a moment of slavery, you have a kind of ultimate choice to constitute yourself as a kind of being relative to that stuff.
As a being who resists the slave system and rejects its efforts to define you. And I guess the notion of responsibility, I think, is important here, too. So I like to think about a distinction in thinking about responsibility between the idea we usually have, which is about holding people responsible, and a rather different idea that we have in ordinary life, which is a matter of taking responsibility. And I think I agree with what John was saying. I think part of the reason that this philosophical movement has continued play for people interested in forming and developing their identities today is that it provides tools for taking responsibility for yourself as it is.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing existentialism with Lanier Anderson from Stanford University.
We've been talking about various dimensions of the central existentialist concept of self-constitution, inventing yourself. Next, we'll turn to the contemporary relevance of existentialism. Do you think existentialism, which after all was a philosophy developed out of the skepticism and pessimism about traditional European values after World War II, do you think it really has any contemporary relevance? Tell us your thoughts. The number is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Existentialism, contemporary life, and your calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Tom T-Bone Stankus and Existential Blues. Boy, does that bring back memories of sipping espresso, talking about Sartre, and listening to Tom T-Bone Stankus, or Or was it Neil Diamond? Anyway, I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. Somehow I can't vision you in a cafe sipping espresso being filled with existential angst, John. I just can't envision it. I'm Ken Taylor. We're discussing existentialism with Lanier Anderson. Do you think existentialism is still a live philosophy, or is its heyday gone? Join us by calling 415-841-4134.
Or
that's 415-841-4134.
Excuse me. Or email us, comments at philosophytalk.org.
So, Lanier, existentialism had its heyday as a cultural movement. Novels, plays, everything. The person before who referred to Richard Wright, lots of people were influenced by existentialism. But I think as a cultural movement, it's kind of a thing of the last century. But as a philosophy, do you think it still has some kind of pull? I mean, is it still?
I do think it still has legs, and I'll give one kind of example of this. So it is true that there was this big cultural movement in what some people call the Sartre years, right after the war, up to about 55. But the central notions of identity and authenticity that the existentialists emphasized continue to be important philosophical ideas even nowadays. And now that there are whole movements that try to build their politics around identity and identification, I think it's important to keep thinking about these concepts in the way that existentialists did.
I think this is extremely important. The notion of identity, existentialist-like notion of identity, has made a huge comeback. Not that it ever went away, but analytic philosophers didn't pay a lot of attention to it. But it's made a huge impact. And Anthony Appiah, who's been our guest on this show a couple of times, puts it this way. My identity, there is this identity that in terms of what I live as, what shall I live as in the world? And that's like a fundamental problem for all of us, trying to decide what we shall live as. And asking the question, are we free to live as whatever we choose to? Are we constrained? And how constrained? And I think existentialism has a lot of insight into that question.
Now Lanier, Cosmo called in and asked us what he should read. When I was a student, I had this anthology by Walter Kaufman called Existentialism from Dostoevsky to Sartre. And boy, I wore that thing out. Is that still available? Is that a good guide? Is there something better?
That's still in print, and I actually sometimes order that for my existentialism class because it's the cheapest location where you can find Sartre's compelling essay, Existentialism as a Humanism. And it has a lot of other great texts from the existentialist tradition in there. Another thing people might want to read is the very interesting biography of Sartre by Annie Cohen-Solal, which is very long but full of great stories.
One thing you probably don't want to do is dig into Being and Nothingness or think you're going to get ready by reading Husserl and Heidegger, because you'll never get to existentialism if you have that life plan.
Irv in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Irv.
Okay, I think existentialism is very pertinent to today. As a high school teacher, I got involved with Samoan kids back in the 60s, and one of the Samoan, they had some trouble because they come from a very traditional society, and one of the Samoan kids put it to me this way. He had some trouble with a teacher, and he asked me, he says, you know, in Samoa there's a fa'a, a way things are done, like, you know, a dowel or path. He says, America, there's so many fa'as, there is no fa'a. And, you know, to me, I think people have to create their own way to a degree. And, you know, that would be I think, one of the main aspects of existentialism, creating meaning for yourself.
Thanks, Irv. I think you're right. Anne, thanks so much for the call. Anne in San Francisco's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Anne.
Well, what you have presented here today really is in opposition to even the atheistic way even the atheists would have some humanitarian desires, and there's a whole movement to help people. And what you have presented here today, it's the self-centeredness and as you mentioned, unrestrained freedom, ultimate choices, your own way. It's not very clear exactly what is presented here. Surely you're not promoting this existentialism, which is really part of the culture of death in this country, and students should be protected from it, not led to it. It is there are aberrations in existentialism, and no one should really want to follow it. What is the real experience? What do they mean?
And you're asking some challenging questions. I'm going to give Lanier a chance to take up the challenge. Can existentialism provide any means for a living together in a shared life, respectful of one another? I mean,
so the existentialist philosophers, in the core sense, Sartre and Beauvoir, did insist that we had particular moral obligations to others, namely to promote the other people's freedom. They didn't want to insist on more substantive moral demands than that, but they did think that it would be inconsistent of an individual agent to try to secure her own freedom without defending the freedom of other people also. And there's quite a bit of controversy over exactly what the argument for that was supposed to be. But I think what Anne is really getting at is the thought that the existentialists refuse to provide substantive guidance about how people ought to live. And they were willing to countenance the thought that different people will choose totally different ways of life, even ways that reject traditional moral values.
But existentialism also says, you know what, this will be a disorienting thought for many, because there is no external authority to which you can appeal to say, oh, yes, that's what I ought to do. God tells me what to do. My parents tells me what to do. The laws of my nation tell me what to do. Wrong. Nobody tells you what to do, at least not with any authority, except if you endow them with that authority.
That's right. And this takes us back to Irv's point that was actually quite an excellent point. Part of what's going on in modern societies is that many different ideas about the way to live come together, and people can become disoriented or disenchanted because they think the presence of these many make it true that there is no one way to live. The existentialists accepted this as a fact that we just have to deal with.
On that note, Lanier, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. It's been a great conversation.
It was my pleasure.
Our guest has been Lanier Anderson, Associate Professor of Philosophy at Stanford University, author of many, many things. Thanks so much for joining us.
We want to also thank the callers, a lot of interesting callers, and some interesting email that we just didn't have time to get to. Thanks for your thoughts. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, this conversation continues on our blog. But, John, what did you learn today? I mean, what's your thinking?
It was a continuation of something I've been learning for some time, really since this student, Charles Watson, that Lanier mentioned was around. You know, you often learn a lot from your graduate students. And I've been getting back into some of the things that I looked at in college, phenomenology, existentialism, to understand if in the more analytic setting that I now prefer, we can make sense of some of these ideas. And it's a great help to have somebody like Lanier Anderson in our department who really understands this stuff backwards and forwards.
Oh, that's true. And, you know, I'm writing a big book on normativity. And as I think more and more and more about normativity, I think the existentialist had something deeply right. They had many things deeply wrong, but there's something deeply right. There is no authority. There is no normative authority except what's in us. It's just that Kant had this rational thing, you know, and God and history and none of that stuff has any authority except if we endow it with that authority. I think the existentialists are
deeply
right.
I think you should write your book in French, Ken.
Well, I don't think I'll write it in French.
You're free to do so.
yeah. But the consequences of my doing it would be very bad for my reputation. But, you know, a film that we've talked about a while ago, just won the Academy Award, Crash. Do you remember? We had a Philosophy Talk Goes the Movie
episode. Thought it was a great movie.
Yeah, and the Academy caught up with us. And just to take a walk down memory lane, we're going to replay our discussion of Crash. Let's bring it back as Philosophy Talk Goes to the Movies. The storyline is really complicated, and you could not summarize it in any short order because there are all these intersecting stories, all these different narrative arcs, all these different people crashing into each other. In the first line of the movie, Don Cheadle says, "We've lost the sense of touch. We all just crash into each other, right, to make contact." And then there are the series of car crashes that get the whole thing going.
Don Cheadle does another amazing job after Hotel Rwanda. The guy is turning into a huge star of serious films.
Let's talk about what the movie's about. It's about ethnic and racial identities. and the role they play in people seeing one another and perceiving one another, or really failing to see and perceive one another.
Well, or I would say situationally seeing one another at one time and not at another. I mean, the guy that seems like the heavy, the Los Angeles Police Department officer who's very racially insensitive and
yeah, that's the Matt
cruel
Dillon
and
character.
Crude, yeah. So he stops a biracial woman with a black man, and he's obviously offended by the situation, maybe because he took her to be white. He gropes her during the arrest. He's just tremendously offensive, and you hate him. And then a little later, he does something quite heroic where he is relating to a non-white person as a person and risks his life to save her.
Yeah, it's very complicated because there is conversion and there is redemption, but it's all there. It's all in the mix. Tragedy, redemption, conversion. But a lot of it is like completely, utterly accidental. And it takes somebody dying for somebody else to turn the corner. It takes somebody almost killing somebody. Right? There's a scene in which an Iranian man who has a store, but his lock is broken. He calls a locksmith. The locksmith is a Latin American who comes to his store and fixes the lock, but the door needs fixing, and so he doesn't fix the door. The store gets robbed. The Iranian man goes to the guy's house and tries to kill him, except his gun has blanks in it, and the guy doesn't end up killing him.
Just by luck.
He would have killed him, except for what philosophers call moral luck.
And that
little bit of moral luck is his moment of redemption. He's redeemed through this act of trying to murder in cold blood another man and by luck not doing it.
Moral luck is the idea that your intentions and your actions and the sense of bodily movements can be the same, but in two different situations, those intentions and movements might result in you doing something truly evil and despicable, where in another situation, it's just a near miss, nothing, no harm done.
But look, what's the philosophical point of this movie? I mean, in one way, it's a critique of kind of the role that racial and ethnic identifications play in us, the way that they blind us to our common humanity. It's complicated, though, because we see the humanity of some, right? So this Matt Dillon character, the cop, the utterly racist pig cop, he sees the humanity of his father. He cares deeply about his father. That actually moves you, the extent to which he cares for his elderly, sick father and the steps he's willing to take. But he doesn't see the humanity of this couple that he stops. But through this other incident that happens that I won't give away, he comes to see their humanity, but only accidentally. He's full of resentment. But how does he throw that resentment off? Not through, you know, his own efforts or something, but because of an utter accident, a situation into which he's thrown, which kind of forces him to throw off these identifications. This is a story of how when you wear your identities heavily, the world can cause all kinds of tragedies for you, but give you a moment of redemption in which you lighten up.
Well, I think you also mentioned another major theme, which is moral luck, and the extent to which the difference between our moral luck and our moral lack of luck shapes our lives and determines who we are and what we deserve is a very deep and intriguing philosophical theme that comes out in this movie in a very powerful way.
I think in a way there's no simple reconciliation that this movie Crash offers us, because, you know, in the end it just starts again. There's another crash, there's another ethnic confrontation, and the moments in which one character sees another character's common humanity despite the ethnic divides that separate them. They're accidental, they're through moral luck, not through their own efforts. I mean, and so the movie says, some people lose out, some people gain. Our common humanity, we keep bumping into each other, sometimes seeing it, many times not seeing it. And when we see it, it's utterly accidental that we see it. And what prevents us from seeing it is identifications, racial, ethnic identification, and wearing them too heavily.
You know, I'd like to mention the movie was directed and written by Paul Haggis, and he's the same guy who wrote Million Dollar Baby. So there's a real talent that's probably going to be producing philosophically rich films for us to discuss for quite some time. Ken, it's fun talking about movies, but it's also fun to help our listeners talk about the philosophical problems that arise in our own life.
Yeah, if you've got a conundrum, you can send us an email at conundrums@philosophytalk.org. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is David Demarest.
Special thanks to Rujin Shin, Neil Van Leeuwen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley, and to our senior consulting producer, Gordon Earle.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW, local public radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.